Angels and Miracles with Rosemary Ellen Kiley. Hey, by the way, get up to coasttocoastam.com. Take a look at the highlight reel. Take a look at the story about the Shroud of Turin. As some Italian researchers are saying, it's the real deal. So go read that story. It's incredible. And we'll be back with more with Rosemary in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Rosemary Ellen Kiley with us. Rosemary, what are you doing for the holidays?
I'm going to be spending it with friends in Connecticut. Very nice, relaxed time. Looking forward to it.
Great. Good for you. Back to angels, back to miracles for a moment. How do we know when people try to summon up an angel that they're not being tricked by some evil entity, a demon of some type?
There certainly are indications of that, and even many people think that the entire spirit world is based on illusion and deceit. It is a factor that we have to take into consideration in some spirit interactions. There does seem to be a level of masquerading where something presents itself in a positive way and then takes the mask off, and after it gets a hold, and things start to go downhill. But angels have a very powerful energy, and they radiate such a high intensity of illumination, light, and divine love that I think it's hard to mistake that. Also, there are ways that we can certainly ask for the bona fides, you know, demonstrate, how do I know that you are who you say you are? And that's demonstrated through communication and through action and other evidence. So for some people, it might be a process that they have to go through in order to trust something. And for others, it's an intuitive knowing in the heart that manifests itself immediately. If you establish a daily practice of prayer and meditation, that is going to improve the refinement of your consciousness so that you have more discernment to begin with. You have a better understanding of the spirit byways out there, so to speak, and you can know what you're contacting and communicating with when it happens.
Why do angels in pictures appear with wings?
Well, that's really an old idea going back to ancient times, where people believed that any being who was a spirit who mediated between the earth and the heaven would have to have wings in order to get back and forth like a bird. actually, there was a great deal of debate in the early Christian church as to whether or not angels had wings. If they had any form at all that could be even depicted. And there were arguments about, well, if something is a spirit, when we perceive it, is that really its accurate form? And if it isn't, we shouldn't be portraying it in art. So this debate really raged on for centuries. But the early church fathers authorized angel images, and the first ones that were done were based a lot on the images of the classical gods from the Greeks and the Romans.
Right, they had that look.
They had that look, kind of a static look. They put very small wings on them because the classical gods had small wings on the either their backs or their heads and helmets or their feet. And over time, these wings got more and more glorious. By the time the church was commissioning grand works of art for all the cathedrals, the artists were using swans as models and adolescent boys to give this kind of androgynous appearance. And so that's where we have all of these paintings with these human-like forms with the enormous wings. So the wing is symbolic of the angel's ability to mediate between the physical and the non-physical. But technically, they don't need wings. And many people, when they perceive angels, see them more as pillars of light without wings.
What are cherubs? Are they little angels?
That's something that really came along in the Renaissance and Baroque art. There are angels called the cherubim, and they are in the dominant hierarchy of angels, the second highest ranking angel. They're the guardians of knowledge in the gates of Eden, and their vibration is one of spiritual illumination and truth. So they're very high level, and in early accounts, they were described as having four wings. Well, in a lot of the Baroque and Renaissance art that became popular, there were little tiny angels. They were actually called putti, but then they started being called cherubs. And these are the little baby-like images with the little tiny wings. They're kind of broken down. I don't want to say broken down in terms of negative, but it's a diminutive version of the cherubim.
When we, you know, like Cupid. Cupid's a little angel, isn't he? Or is he a cherub?
Well, that would be along the lines of the putti and cherub model, yes. An angelic presence. And the childlike image, too, represents innocence, purity, naivety, and love is pure. And so when one is struck by the arrow of love, it comes from this pure figure who bears, you know, original cosmic innocence.
What's a gargoyle?
Well, gargoyles actually have a protective function, and those are these grotesque statues.
Oh, my gosh, they look scary.
They look demonic, and they're
they
supposed
do, yeah.
to. Their purpose is to keep evil spirits away. And when the great cathedrals were being built throughout Europe, gargoyles were incorporated into the structure specifically to repel demonic influences.
So when you look at these statues of gargoyles, you know, they look evil in themselves. You know, when you look at these old Hollywood movies, they're on the outside of these old houses and things like that. But then their original intent was to keep spirits, bad spirits, from coming into the house, right?
That's right. It's sort of like, well, it takes one to know one. So if you're trying to repel something horrible, malevolent, and ugly, you get something even uglier.
Can it turn on you, though?
I don't think so. We have that motif in Hollywood, of course, you know, where just about anything can become a raging demonic force. But I've always considered gargoyles to be a benevolent, protective influence, and I have them in my house.
You do?
I do. I have them in my library, my office, and as decorative items around the house. I think it's important to surround yourself with representations of energies and forces that you wish to have in your environment. And as you know, George, I'm involved heavily in investigations and sometimes of unpleasant cases and places.
That's right.
And so when I come home, my home is my sanctuary, and I like to keep it that way through sacred sound and meditation, prayer. And I have my own items around the house that represent qualities to me, to protective qualities, to, you know, keep the peace.
So you've never been concerned about your gargoyles turning on you?
No.
Well, that's a good thing. Angels, they seem to have names, don't they? Gabriel, Michael. How come?
The name actually represents the quality or job of the angel. And there aren't very many angels named in the Bible. In fact, there's only three, Gabriel, Michael, and Raphael. And in the ex-canonical text, there are many more names. But the IEL is a suffix that generally means of God. And so the name would be like something of God, courage of God, light of God, son of God. And some of the other names, they're thousands of angels and thousands of names when you get into the apocryphal literature and the magical literature. And some of them are never really translated in terms of what they mean. They don't all end in the IEL. But the concept behind that is a name is a vibration. It's a spiritual vibration that is used for summoning. You know, you summon something by its mm-hmm. name. You identify with a name, you connect through a name. And that's why it's important for these entities to have names. It's really for us. It's a means of us being able to make the contact with them.
Who named them? Mankind?
That's a very good question, where the names originated from, because they're in the earliest writings. And I think that names become impressed on our consciousness. If we send out the question, who are you and who are you dealing with, we will get an answer back. And that can come through thoughts impressed in the head, through dreams, through through a more dramatic kind of experience where we are in a visual presence of a being. So I think that they have an identification that is an embodiment of their spiritual vibration. And that has to get translated for us somehow into a vibration of sound that we can understand and use. So names may be an approximation for us of the actual embodiment of the energy. But names do work, and we have used names throughout human history as a way of connecting to all kinds of spiritual forces, including God and the gods and goddesses.
Have you ever had some kind of angelic experience, Rosemary?
I certainly have, George, and that's really what piqued my interest in studying angels in more depth. I had some childhood experiences. You know, when you're a kid, you think everybody has the same experiences, and you don't wonder about them so much. But I had experiences with angels. I didn't see them, but I knew they were around me. I called them angels, and they were choirs. They sang to me. I could literally hear them singing. And sometimes this would be while I'd be playing by myself, or I'd be going to sleep or reading. And that seemed to be very normal to me. It was not until I got to be a lot older, into adulthood, that I began having visitation experiences. And those seemed to be very purposeful for me. I was getting into metaphysics. I was making my own spiritual inquiries. And more of my professional work as a writer was turning in that direction. And so I had some very influential visitation experiences that started in dreams, where I was in the presence of beings that I could only call angels, because they were guides. They looked like what I thought an angel ought to look like, and they were instructors, and showing me things and teaching me things that eventually started being part of my work. I've also had angel experiences that were more mystical in nature, moments of spiritual illumination, being swept up into a higher presence where you're really beyond words. You're just in a field of energy that impacts you at the intuitive heart level. And I've had healing experiences involving angels, psychological healing, emotional, physical healing, visitations at night with figures, or you know, that come to the bedside. And these can happen to anyone. Sometimes people have maybe one experience in life that really convinces them that they have this connection to a presence that mediates between them and the divine. And other people have them frequently. But the more you pray and meditate and set your intention toward advancing your spiritual consciousness, the more likely you are to have these kinds of experiences.
Why do we all have guardian angels, or do we?
I think we do. And this seems to be, well, various explanations are this is part of the covenant of God, that God has assigned guardian angels to watch over people, and also to keep records about us. Some of them are recording angels that are said to write down our every thought, word, and deed in the Book of Life, and that this is used in the transition to the afterlife as, in old terms, the judgment, or in new terms, the life assessment. And it's a permanent record of what we did when we were in this incarnation. But it does say in the Bible, in Psalms, that God says he will set his angels in charge over thee, and, you know, so that you don't, you know, hit your foot against a stone and you're protected against the dangers of outside forces, mm-hmm. symbolically. So this seems to be part of the original cosmic scheme that, you know, it's a thorny path out there for us in this planet, and provisions have been made from the divine to have help available to us, spiritual help available to us at all times.
Rosemary, how do we know that we're having angelic intervention as opposed to our own instincts and intuitiveness?
I think it's actually a combination of things. Some people, externalize this more than others. And there are times I think that everybody has an experience where something seems to be visited from outside of oneself, a moment of crisis, a profound revelation, a dramatic rescue even, where outside forces seem to intervene on one's life. But we can't really remove ourselves from this process because what's going on in our consciousness has plays a role in organizing cosmic forces in motion. And this plays into miracles as well, that our thoughts and intentions go out and mix with the thoughts and intentions of other people, with the cosmic forces. And when the recipe is right, so to speak, there is an interaction, a meaningful interaction, and we get something that seems to be a miracle or divine grace, you know, a visit by an angelic messenger, when actually we're really participating in the experience rather than being the passive recipients of it. This is what I think we need to learn more. We do have the capability of engaging in that process in a more deliberate, conscious way. And I think that the miracle really is capable of becoming more of our ordinary reality rather than a special occurrence that some people say, well, you know, it only happens to the worthy. Well, we're all worthy. We came onto this planet as worthy beings, and we all have the same ability and opportunities to develop our spiritual awareness to very high levels, and it's really up to us. It's our responsibility to do that, but we have the opportunity. It's a gift. It really is a gift from the cosmos.
Well, it probably is. Do you think with the angelic intervention that evil people will still have angels try to help them?
I think they do, and I think angels are... forces that are around all the time, I don't think that they can force us to do anything. We do have free will. That is part of our cosmic spiritual birthright. And so if we make choices to turn away from good, an angel is not going to come along and yank us back and say, you know, look, you know, you're going the wrong way. This is what you got to do. Now, in the old biblical model, those kinds of things would happen where it was not a happy thing if an angel showed up, because it usually meant that God was very unhappy with you and was coming to punish you or warn you that you were going to get punished if you didn't change your ways. And we have a different view of that process today. I think that we are always given opportunities to redeem ourselves, to turn to the highest path, to let go of some negative way of living or even malevolent acts. And that this is a redemptive process, and the help is always available to us and will push opportunities and signals at us, intuitions, opportunities, events, circumstances, but we still make the choice whether or not to change.
We're going to take some questions later with Rosemary Ellen Guiley, but when I come right back on Coast to Coast AM, we shall talk about miracles and a little bit more of spirit intervention and how we enter 2012. I'm George Norrie. We will be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Rosemary Ellen Guiley. Let's talk to her about miracles next when we come right back. And welcome back to Coast, Rosemary Ellen Guiley with us. Rosemary, talk a little bit about spirit intervention, and then we'll get into some miracles. You believe these spirits and entities intervene into our affairs in order to help us or change events?
Well, they can certainly influence the course of events, but I do believe that we are in the driver's seat on that. We put out forces into the world. We are incarnated in the physical world. We are oriented through physicality to events. Our actions, our intentions, our thoughts, are the primary influences on what happens here. And, of course, we have the forces of nature, too, which have their own cycles. And we are aided by spiritual forces. And if enough collective energy is built up in any one direction, that can have a significant impact, I think, on what happens on the physical level. Now, there are lots of concepts of celestial wars and various agendas going on and hostile entities who would like to influence the course of events. But I think that they work through people to do that. They influence people and their thoughts and actions. That's how things get played out in the physical world.
Interesting. But you believe that the dead can also influence us from the afterlife as well?
I think that they can. I think that their influence is on a different level, much more, I would say, benign. Most of the communication that we have from the dead is of a concerned nature. People who want to stay close to the living, close to loved ones, have a desire to help humanity. And the some of the communications that we've gotten in instrumental transcommunication, the high-tech end of spirit communication, indicates that there are groups of people, human souls on the other side, who are working with higher beings that we might call angels or other highly evolved beings, to exert positive influences on the planet. But these are streams of influences. They're energies, and we are putting out our own streams of influences and energies, and so we get this cosmic brew of forces in motion going on all the time. And those can influence where those forces go and what the outcomes are. We're in a sea of probabilities all the time.
Well, we sure are. Now, as we enter 2012 and just a stone's throw away, what do you think the year will unfold with?
I think we're going to continue to have a lot of chaos and upset. I think that there's going to be a turning point in the year. Hopefully when people see that it's not going to be a giant collapse or apocalypse or the end of the world scenario, I don't see that happening at all. I think there will be a turning point where people will be inspired to put their energy, their thought and intention and effort and spiritual side of themselves into positive action rather than, I don't want to see people waiting around for the end of the world or doomsday. That's the wrong position to be in. We have to be proactive.
Rosemary, miracles, they happen all the time. They're remarkable. Do sometimes we manifest them ourselves, or is it always some kind of intervention?
I think all miracles are partnership of human consciousness, the divine, and cosmic forces in motion. And the old view of miracles, which literally means wonder working, is that miracles were visited upon people as a gift from God, usually for being worthy or part of being, you know, a state of worthiness, a reward for something or a sign of God's promise to human beings. And yet we also see, even just from the Bible, that we have the ability within ourselves to do that as well. And in the New Testament, Jesus says, he who believes in me will have the same ability to do what I do. And, you know, if you have the faith, go out and do it. And that's exactly what the apostles do after the crucifixion, to demonstrate wonder-working ability. And that tradition is carried on in the communion of saints. But still, somewhere along the line, human beings in general haven't made the connection that this power lies within. And it's not that we're all, you know, wonder-working magicians, but we have the power to tap into cosmic forces and help miracles manifest. We are active participants, not passive recipients. This is an important switch in mindset for human beings. We tend to sit back and say, oh, we're at the mercy of this, we're at the mercy of that, we have to ask for this, ask for that. And we should ask, but we need to ask in terms of what we can do proactively to set forces in motion and influence them for the higher good, the higher betterment. Mm-hmm. And that's the mindset that we need to continue to develop.
What would your definition of a miracle be?
Well, the traditional definition of a miracle is an extraordinary event that has no ordinary explanation. From another perspective, no natural explanation. And I think that actually miracles are part of the natural world, and that's really more of an Eastern view of miracles. And I have a book out called Develop Your Miracle Mind Consciousness, where I look at concepts of miracles from different viewpoints. And in the Eastern viewpoint, miracles are part of the natural world. They're around us all the time for us to participate in. They're not extraordinary events. They're more ordinary events. And then we develop our ability to participate in this in a more intentional way through our spiritual path. So what I think can happen for us, and may even be happening now, is an evolution of our spiritual consciousness to redefine what a miracle is, our role in it, and how these play out in our physical environment and also in our spiritual environment.
Would you say the birth of a baby is a miracle?
Well, life itself is indeed a miracle. And so absolutely, yes. Life, the planet that we're on, I'm constantly amazed at the beauty of this world that we're on, even, you know, with all of our problems on it, and the miracle of life itself, that all of these sentient organisms, from the lowliest up through human beings on this planet, have the capability of having life and consciousness and awareness. It is a miracle.
When you want a miracle, people pray for miracles, I assume, right?
Yes, they do.
How do we know that, and you talked about consciousness a little bit, how do we know that the mass consciousness isn't getting this done as opposed to God or angels? Now, that's a push because it might be all one and the same.
I think it's a mix. I really do. Does God have the ability to visit miracles upon us? Certainly. But human beings, I think, have always underestimated their role in this process. And all of our religions and spiritual traditions have attempted, really, to teach how to spiritualize our consciousness. And we still tend to think that, well, this is something that's out of our power. It's not. Even from a parapsychology standpoint, the research into PK, psychokinesis, demonstrates another aspect of that. That's literally mind over matter, using your intense, focused thoughts to affect something on the physical plane. Now, if a single person can focus his thoughts to raise the temperature of water, turn a light off and on, influence the roll of dice, these are all laboratory kinds of experiments. What is the potential if millions of people join their thoughts together in a common goal? We would see PK on a big scale. And actually, I think we do. I think that we, without even realizing it, influence things on this planet, our weather patterns, perhaps even events, by having collective thought in a certain direction. That's why when we're faced with this 2012 thing, which I consider to be rather artificially manufactured, it's so important to use the media to not to focus on the negative, but to focus on something positive. Okay, it's an end of a cycle. What's the new cycle? You know, let's birth a new cycle into being and not get caught up in being destroyed in something we think is beyond our power. It's not beyond our power.
No, it's not. And it's whatever's out there, it's a miracle that it happens, isn't it?
I think everything on this planet is miraculous in some way. Having a soul incarnating experience on Earth is a treasured miracle. And if we were more aware of that every day, even if we put a few minutes into that every day, we could really transform things on an amazing scale. But people have to realize that power. They have to realize that it is within them and it is capable of being used. Now, anytime we have group prayer, we've all read stories about prayer chains and prayer groups and the things that flow out from that. That is collective thought. That is focused, intent thought toward a goal. And there's been a lot of debate, of course, in the religious and spiritual and even the alternative healing communities in terms of should the goal be directed or should it be non-directed? Should it be non-directed toward higher good and let things play out as they should play out, or should we be specific? And I think there are times to be specific and times to be non-directed, and that they're both very purposeful and beneficial.
Well, I think so, too. And when miracles occur, some of them life-altering, do people, are they changed forever, Rosemary?
Many of them are. People can have their entire lives turned around, their spiritual views changed. There can be an amazing inner transformation. I think a lot of it depends on the individual and the event that occurs. For some people, what others might consider to be a miracle and look at it from a spiritual context, that person might consider it a lucky break. Oh, I got lucky. You know, the forces of the universe aligned for me and I got lucky. So it just depends on where we are in our own awareness and our own spiritual path, how we integrate these experiences. But for many people, you're absolutely right. They are completely life-transforming.
It was one of a kind when this happens, indeed. The story I always remember when people called in about miracles, the truck driver going over a cliff, hand comes in, pulls him back on. A woman whose son had attempted suicide in the garage, she couldn't lift him up, but something gave her the strength, and she felt some arms pushing him up with her to save him. A guy who drowns, he's out in the ocean, a hand reaches down and pulls him up. There's nobody else there. Stories like that. How do you explain that, Rosemary?
The only way we can explain it is in terms of a miracle, and I've interviewed many people who've had similar stories. And here again, we get back to that question you asked earlier, why does it happen for one person and not for another? And there's no good answer to that. I think that when we're in these crises situations, literally in a split second between life and death, there may be something in our consciousness that goes out without us being aware of it in terms of asking for help, you know, God, please save me, or I don't want to die, or something like that. But there's an intensity and a focus to it that generates something back. But we still don't know where that fits into the path of our soul in our life journey and experiences that perhaps we've even chosen to have. Not that anyone would choose to have a violent death, but there are many different kinds of experiences that we seem to need to have on a soul level in order to be wholly integrated at some point in our soul's journey. These are tough questions to grapple with, and sometimes I think the answers are not real pretty. But miracles that do happen serve to demonstrate to the rest of us what the capabilities and the potentials are. And we need to sit up and pay attention that there may be a consciousness to cultivate where we are in a better stream of what we would call miracle manifestation that takes our physical existence to a different kind of level where these sorts of events don't need to happen or at least happen as often.
The other countries that are maybe a little more advanced than we are in terms of metaphysical, do they all have similar belief systems about angels and miracles and intervention?
We find beliefs about celestial intervening figures everywhere, and they come by different names. They're not all called angels, but the concept of intermediaries and interveners is universal and has been so since ancient times. And it seems that, you know, beliefs in miracles are fairly uniform and common, too, although they do vary, as I mentioned a little earlier. From the Eastern view, miracles are more part of the natural world, and one can cultivate a stronger participation in that energy through spiritual development. One of the paths to that would be through yoga. And in some other cultures like ours, we still tend to consider it more as a visitation from outside influences and sources. So we've got the basic building blocks all over the planet and in all of our traditions and cultures. And we seem to come at these things from different perspectives at different times in history and places. And ultimately, I think we're all looking at the same thing.
Well, we sure are. And, you know, we will all get there maybe the same way, but through different paths, perhaps.
That seems to be the case, and of course that's said many times, that all spiritual traditions, despite their differences, all lead to the same place.
It does amaze me how so many different religions all seem to pinpoint very similar aspects of life and about, you know, just spirituality. The similarities are just uncanny, aren't they?
They really are, and it indicates that we really are united in a very fundamental way, a very fundamental soul way on this planet, no matter how at odds we are with each other, which seems to characterize human history. There's not a decade on this planet that we haven't been at war somewhere over something. And I've often wondered how long it's going to take for human beings to get beyond that. And mystics have commented on this. Sri Aurobindo, who's one of my favorites, talked about, you know, the eventuality of kind of like a supermind where human beings would get beyond all of this, but he foresaw it, if we lasted long enough, happening very far into the future. But we need to keep putting energy in that direction if that process is going to continue and benefit us. And those changes then become, I think, permanent, a permanent part of the collective human consciousness that enables us to keep advancing. It's sort of like building a tower one story at a time.
Are there angels among us, walking among us?
I believe so, every day. I think that they come in a variety of ways. They come in a spiritualized form that may not be visible to us, but is certainly felt among us, and I think that they take on physical form. I even am inclined to think that angels have the capability of incarnating in human form if it serves a particular purpose.
All right, stay with us, Rosemary. We're going to come back for a final hour with you, but this time we'll take phone calls, questions for Rosemary Ellen Guiley, and miracle stories as well. I'm George Norrie. We'll be right back.